Let's do this, the Cult of Hockey podcast by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David.
How you doing?
Well, for a snowy September, not bad. You know, I just yesterday I was saying to my son, this is my 50th September in Alberta. I've lived number of years in Newfoundland as well, but I actually figured out this is my 50th September here, and I wasn't sure if I'd ever seen five snowy days in September in those previous 49 years, and yesterday we had snow for the fifth day in a row, and it's like in the forecast this morning as well.
Jeez. It's like December in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Endless socked in, drizzly. If you ever, people say, oh, Vancouver is such a great city. well, my wife lived there a couple years, and some people from Alberta move out there, Bruce, they cannot take it because of the lack of sunshine. And I think like the last 5 days has given us a taste of what it's like in Vancouver in the winter, just mm-hmm. this socked in. I find it depressing. I can't stand it. It's okay when it's not raining, like if it's just wet and gray, but man, when it's raining, I hate it.
It's summer, still in the summer months, technically, until the 23rd, right? I mean, we're still a week away from the solstice, and we're already, feels like a week in the winter.
Yeah, we had like a month of smog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then a month of this.
Yeah, and then I turn on the TV and I see what's happening in Carolina, and I say, what are you whining about, Bruce? You got it good.
You've seen those pictures of the weather, people fighting to stand up in the pictures, and then the guys just walk by.
I saw that one.
Those are hilarious. And that does not do the news profession any favors, those kinds of clips. All right, Bruce, the Oilers, first preseason game tonight. We're going to talk about that a little bit, and we're going to talk about Darnell Nurse's contract, and we're going to talk about the return of the Swarm. But first, we're going to start off with some older news. There was, when Bob McKenzie spoke out last week, he's such a sober, careful commentator, and his commentary on the Oilers was so harsh that it kind of took me aback, and on one level, completely agreed with it. But there, it also bothered me on another level. Like, is this really true? Is this really a crime against hockey humanity if the Oilers don't make the playoffs in McDavid's younger seasons here? Because we hear that especially now, like when a player is on the first 3 years of his contract, they got to win the cup because of the window that you have under the cap. But just how realistic is that? Although we've seen it a few times with Taves and Crosby in recent years, just how realistic is a scenario? Is it for when a young generational superstar arrives in a team, how often do we see that team take right off and stay high and keep on going strong? So, and is it really a crime against hockey humanity if it takes a few years for that team to take off, or if that team goes up and down rather dramatically, like happened with the Oilers year to year? You know, what do we see? So, Bruce, I found there's about, I'll just find the story here, call it up. I found a list of 15 players, including McDavid, who I consider to be generational talents. And there's some from every decade on the list. So they go from Howie Morenz, Eddie Shore, Maurice Richard, Gordie Howe, Jean Béliveau, Bobby Hull, Stan Mikita, Wayne Gretzky, Guy Lafleur, Bobby Orr, Mario Lemieux, Sidney Crosby. I think I got a pretty good list there, Bruce, of the generational superstars in hockey. Do you think I missed anyone?
Well, you left out the goalies.
Yeah, I did leave out the goalies on purpose, right? Because there hasn't been a generational superstar goalie. There's been goalies who have panned out as stars, but these are players, the kind of players I'm talking about were identified to a man at an early age, I think, as supernovas. And then as teenagers, generally speaking, sometimes a little later, became these superstars and then maintained it throughout their career. So like Eric Lindros was on that trajectory, mm-hmm. but flamed out, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would have been considered putting Lindros on the list, just as an example. You know, all the guys that you mentioned here are guys that did go on to win the Stanley Cup, which is fair, but it also, in one sense, it biases the sample, if that's a prerequisite. Whereas Lindros, I mean, he certainly came in as a generational superstar. There's no other way to put it. And I'm pretty sure that by year four of his career, I think that was actually
Legion of Doom.
Yeah, actually, it was the third year of his career that he won the Hart, did he not? And Jagr won the Ross. They tied for the scoring lead. And then in his fifth year, Lindros's team went to the Stanley Cup Finals, but got swept and then never to return.
I had every player had to win at least two Stanley Cups on this list, except for McDavid. So you're right. Like, it's skewed towards players who not only were generational superstars coming in, but actually had great success in their careers. But that's kind of what I wanted to look at. Mm-hmm. So what I found, Bruce, is this. Some of these players do come in, and more than half of them came onto teams that were below average teams in terms of their percentile.
Especially the
Crosby, McDavid, Lemieux, or they all came to teams that were in the bottom 10th percentile. Mm-hmm. Crosby and McDavid, in their first year, their teams were in the fifth percentile in the league. Mm-hmm. Crosby was on the worst, 29 out of 30. McDavid at 29 out of 30. Lemieux's team was 7th percentile, 20 out of 21, and Orr's was the worst team, 6 out of 6.
And all those teams finished last the year before that guy came there, except for McDavid, where the Oilers won the lottery from third last.
Yeah.
The generational players, by the way, the system and the draft system is designed, they go to the crappiest teams. And so they always have a big hill to climb at the start of their career, these guys. Now that Sam Pollock is out of the league.
Yes, LaFleur is kind of the last guy that went to a good team because Pollock was so crafty. I mean, he almost got his hands on Gretzky, wasn't that? He made that trade with to get the 1980 first overall pick, I think, which projected to be Gretzky, but turned out to be Wickenheiser.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken about that, maybe it was Grunman who made that trade. Anyway, So how quickly did they turn it around? Well, a couple of the players, like they did, it was fantastic. Like Bobby Orr, the Bruins go from the worst team in the league to one of the best teams in the league by his second year. And we see, generally speaking, the team's trending up and trending up pretty fast with most of the players. But a handful of players, and especially the players on the weaker teams, like Clark, Bobby Hull, and Lemieux, their teams took a while, Bruce, to become elite teams in the NHL. Like Lemieux, his first year, so the year before he gets there, the team's in the second percentile. Then it moves to the seventh percentile in his first year. Bumps up to the 31st percentile in his second year. 40th percentile in his third year. 45th percentile in his fourth year. McDavid's just heading into his fourth year. Right. So it, with McDavid, if they're the equivalent to the Pittsburgh Penguins, another generational player, they'd be in the 45th percentile this year. And was that, I don't remember that being considered a crime against hockey humanity at the time. Bobby Clark's Philadelphia Flyers took a long time to get going as well. So there was the interesting thing, though, and I think what makes the Oilers situation pretty dramatic, Bruce, is the fact that they actually did rock it up. But unlike some teams like Bobby Orr's Bruins, they didn't, and Gretzky's Oilers, who rocketed up in his third year. The Oilers didn't, obviously, they didn't stay there. They had this incredible crash. And the fascinating thing was, there was only one other case with all these 15 players where the team would rocket up and then crash. And that was the 1925-26 Montreal Canadiens. Howie Morenz was a superstar on that team. Every bit as big a superstar in his day, I think, as Connor McDavid is now, or close to it. But there was some really weird circumstances with that team. So it had gone to the Stanley Cup final the year before. And I think that was in Morenz's second year. Mm-hmm. And they rocketed down to the worst team in the league in his third year. But Bruce, they had a goalie by the name of Georges Vezina, You may have heard the name, Vezina. Yeah. He was their starting goalie when they went to the Stanley Cup Finals. But in the first game of the season, he only played one game in 25-26 because he came down with tuberculosis. And he would actually die that same year in March of 1926. So they had this legendary goalie, and they never did replace him. The goalie they brought in only played one NHL season. That season, he let in one more goal per game than Vezina had the year earlier, and one more goal per game than the new goalie, George Hainsworth, another legendary goalie, would let in the year after. So they were clearly, that demise was clearly the result, I think, of Vezina's illness and death. And also they did lose a few players. They lost a Hall of Fame player, Sprague Cleghorn, who was kind of the Chris Pronger of his era. And that was another blow to that team. So the Oilers, I don't think, had equivalent hardship last year in terms of their drop. It was kind of an unprecedented thing. And this, I think, gives weight, more weight, to McKenzie's claim that this is a crime against hockey humanity for the Oilers not to make the playoffs, because whatever happened last year was arguably unprecedented for a team with a generational superstar. And it was downright awful. So I was left with the thought that McKenzie his comments were certainly fair comment, and possibly just, you know, pretty close to bang on. Although, you know, it's not unexpected to take a while too. So there is that balancing. What do you make of it all, Bruce?
Well, one thing that a little bit is surprising, I guess, is that you can't look at this list and say, well, in some cases, the player himself went down and then that team collapsed. I mean, as a group, the gradual upward trend of the team continued with, you know, even it was Mario or that missed some time, but there wasn't a case where you say, well, the player in his 34th season suffered a catastrophic injury and the team went into the tank. Certainly the situation you mentioned in Montreal there with Georges Vezina, I mean, you'd have to think that would have an impact on the whole team, not just the losing.
And they had fewer players on those teams, right? There was two lines.
Die during the season, you know. I mean, that's pretty rough. But yeah, sure. I mean, last year's Oilers fallback. I mean, thing is, I'm not sure the league has ever had more parity than it does now, and the knife edge between a successful team and one that isn't a lot. And last year, I mean, the Oilers. I mean, Chiarelli talked famously about death by a thousand cuts, and they had. I mean, if you look at the games missed, well, McDavid didn't miss any games, but he was in rough shape for a while. And the other guys that missed games that were key players, they didn't necessarily miss a lot of games, but they played a whole lot of other games where they just weren't up to snuff, either before they went on the injured reserve or after they came back. I mean, Leon had that concussion. He had a tough first part of the season. You had Larson, who was playing through a back injury and finally went on the shelf, and then he came back, and then something else happened to him, kind of ruined his season for sure. Klefbom, that was playing, apparently hurt from the beginning of training camp, and was less than 100% both before and after. He spent three different times on the injured reserve. Sekera, whose season, you know, he didn't even start until Christmas time. And he was never even close to the player that he had been. And Cam Talbot, who, you know, he missed eight games, but apparently he was playing through something that before. And then when he came back, they immediately played him 17 games in a row. They started him, which I think was a coaching error last year. And I'm just not sure he ever really got found his. And I mean, Dreisaitl is the key, you know, the second key offensive player, obviously, on the team. And if you can find four defensive players more important than Talbot, Sekera, Klefbom, and Larson, I'd like to know who they are.
Yeah, good point, Bruce. So essentially, the top two centers and the top four defensive players, including which one of them is the goalie, who's the most important defensive player, all had some injury illness issues last year with the Oilers that affected them for months, if not the entire year. And so that's a factor, right? Because maybe you add that all up, and that's the equivalent of Montreal losing their starting goalie that same year, 25-26.
They were all healthy, so maybe they outperformed what you'd expect in sort of a normal health year, right? Because all those guys were healthy, and they were, they really rode a wave, so they probably were not quite as good as their 2016-17 record suggests. And then last year, obviously, it went south to the tune of minus 25 points.
So what do you think? Is it a crime against hockey humanity if they don't make the playoffs, I guess? I think that's the standard.
If McDavid himself is healthy all year and they don't make the playoffs, then yes.
Yeah, I agree. I think I agree.
If something were to happen to McDavid, then you know, I'm not sure that you could say that they wasted a McDavid year if something happened to the actual player himself. But let's not talk about that. Let's just say he's healthy and keeps going where he's going, where I think he's going is upwards and onwards, and I think he's going to pull this team. And he's going to make the team better and better enough that they're going to be a playoff team is my fearless, actually very fearful prediction.
Well, that's the good thing. If you look at this chart, I mean, if you're looking for bad things, you can look at the Oilers crash last year. But if you're looking for good things, when you look at all these generational superstars, man, it's astonishing. They all of these teams just get better and better. So like on average, let me just go to the average here. On average in the player's first year, they're in the 47th percentile, these 15 teams. They're in the 38th percentile, actually, the year before, on average, the year before the superstar arrives. In the superstar's second year, they on average, they're in the 69th percentile. So they go up 22 percentile. In the third year, 71 percentile. And in the fourth year, 84 percentile. That's where, on average, these teams with these superstars are. So to expect the Oilers to be in the 50th percentile this year, only one team, Lemieux's Penguins, weren't in that. And I think this team is demonstrably better than Mario Lemieux's Penguins were in his fourth year. They took a long time with that team to get anything going. So, yeah, I'm not a betting man, Bruce, but I actually think it's a good bet to bet on the Oilers making the playoffs. I'm going to be as bullish as that. I think it's a good bet they're going to make the playoffs this year. That that what we looked at last year wasn't Georges Vezina the dying, but it was all those injuries and sicknesses and illnesses. It was a lot of players playing hurt and not being their best selves. So if most of those guys can have healthy years, there's absolutely no reason at all they should not make the playoffs. Right. Let's move on, Bruce, to let's quickly talk about Darnell Nurse's contract situation. So he's Dustin Nielsen of TSN, who is a really entertaining guy on the radio. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And also, he's been kind of deferential on a certain level. I mean, he's really mouthy, but deferential on a certain level to the hockey experts, right? Mm-hmm. But he's getting more and more outspoken. Mm-hmm. As he's getting more comfortable. And I think kind of his opinion, which is often a little bit especially for the mainstream guys, he's more out there. He'll take a stand which is outside the norm. Like he's a big advocate for Jesse Puljujärvi, for instance.
Yes, he sure is.
Not something we generally see from the mainstream guys.
No.
So he also is getting more insider information. So I like his work, and his report yesterday said that Nurse's camp values him at $4 million, a little bit more than $4 million per. Now he made it clear that wasn't the ask. They weren't demanding that. It's kind of, maybe this is a distinction without a difference, but they're saying to the Oilers, well, we think this is a $4 million player here. We're willing to give him for 3.7 or 3.8 million. Maybe that's the difference. What did you make of it? What do you think of the valuation and that ask, and what they might be asking based on it?
Well, it depends if you're valuing apples and oranges, is the old saying, or apples and road apples is another way of putting it. I mean, if you're comparing Darnell Nurse's season to, say, Chris Russell's season last year, a very strong case can be advanced that Nurse had the better season, and Russell has paid $4 million. Therefore, Nurse is worth at least $4 million and $1, right? Of course, the reality is that Russell was signed as a free agent and basically extended as a as an immediately impending free agent.
An unrestricted free agent.
Yes, sorry. With the other defensemen on the team, the $4 million guys, two of them, Klefbom and Larson, were signed as younger players, either just coming out of their entry-level contract or 1 year after that, a little north of $4 million, but for long-term, and they bought, you know, three-plus UFA seasons over the course of their contract. So, I mean, if Nurse's agent values him at a little over $4 million and says, we're prepared to sign for six, seven, 8 years at that, hey, get her done. I'm saying that.
He's not saying that.
As an RFA with no arbitration rights coming out of his entry-level contract, that he thinks he's already worth $4 million. Well, I'm sorry, but the market has spoken otherwise, and it spoke very loudly and clearly yesterday when Josh Morrissey signed 2 years, $3.15 million in Winnipeg. And Josh Morrissey is a very good comparable for Darnell Nurse, at least at the statistical level, which is where, the, you know, when they do take cases to arbitration and they do comparables, I mean, it is largely the, you know, the production numbers that they look at and so on. And Morrissey, I mean, Morrissey, 7 goals, 19 assists, 26 points plus 15. Nurse, 6 goals, 20 assists, 26 points plus 15. I mean, they're almost indistinguishable. And they're, I've heard some people make the case, well, Nurse is playing on a worse team, therefore he deserves more. That makes me think, well, does that mean the teams with the very worst teams in the league should have the highest payroll and the best team should have the lowest? I mean, it's kind of counterintuitive on the one level. Morrissey's team had more success. Maybe he deserves more for that. I mean, you can argue and counter-argue everything. But when you look at the cold, hard numbers, Nurse did play a few percent more ice time than Morrissey, about a minute and a half a game more. I've been saying all along, David, all summer, I've had him, the white space on my depth chart, estimating a $3.2 million cap hit for Nurse. And that's right where, I mean, you've also got Brandon Montour in Anaheim that came in a little under $3.4 million. And he's sort of the top comparable. And as I recall, he had more points in fewer games. You know, anyway, the range, though, is somewhere below $3.5 million over 2 years, whereas if you're hearing this talk about $4 million now, even if they're not asking for that, really, the market suggests they shouldn't expect even $3.5 million, and that's over 2 years. If I were the other area of contention, maybe they want a one-year deal, after which he does get arbitration rights, and potentially, if he has another good year, a big bump in pay. But if I were the Oilers, if he was asking for 1 year only, I would go way lower, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, you want a two-year deal, we'll give you 3.25. You want a one-year deal, we'll give you 2.5. You know, you can take your pick.
Yeah, the market's spoken. Like, now that two of these players have signed, and they signed for 3.1 and 3.4, because they're all really him, Nurse, Jose, not Jose Theodore, but Shea Theodore, mm-hmm. Brandon Montour, and Josh Morrissey were all really comparable players. Mm-hmm. Just very strong comparables, all of them. And Montour signed for a little bit more. If Nurse signs for $3.4 million, that's fine with me. I mean, he's also a decent comparison for Brandon Montour. So anywhere in there works for me. I think that it just comes down now to stubbornness and how much does the player really want, because the market has been set for this kind of player. Mm-hmm. There's no argument, I think, that Nurse is a better player right now than Brandon Montour. So for him to be saying, I need 3.8 or 3.7 or like, why? How does that make sense? There's not a strong argument. So the only way you can get that is sitting out and the Oilers become desperate. So it becomes apparent to the Oilers that they're so desperate they must pay this player that amount. But Bruce, there's a little bit of a problem with that in that the Oilers have a top four defense. Like, they have four guys. It's not necessarily great, but let's say Klefbom and Larson come back and play like they're capable of playing, like they did in the 2017 playoffs when they were a really good top pairing. And then you have Russell and Benning in the second pairing. That's more iffy, obviously. But Benning and Russell will be on his natural left side, and that's a pairing that can certainly get by for a while. So Nurse is, you know, if he's going to play that game where he, and then you start missing paychecks too. Like, I don't think the Oilers make, it's not when he comes back he gets that full amount. He just keeps getting the paycheck based on his salary, does he not? Like, it's not like he gets, if he got $3.8 million, it wouldn't be scrunched into the rest of the year. No, I think it would be, you signed for the year, I think you'd be missing paychecks. And I could be mistaken about that, but I think he'd be missing some money. So it just seems like he should be, if the money's between 3.1 and 3.4, if that's Oilers offer, sign the deal, man, and get in camp and start working towards, start learning the new systems that are in place, the new coaches that are in place, what they've got to offer. Trent Yanni built the play of other players in Anaheim, like Brandon Montour, and get ready to earn your next big payday. It's not coming now. What's that?
I say, and Shea Theodore.
Yes.
That Yanni coached when he was in Anaheim. So, yeah. I think the one area where the Nurse camp, one area they can focus on negotiation is the split in the salary for the 2 years. Right? You come in at an AAV of whatever figure. And unfortunately, Cap Friendly doesn't yet have the breakdown of the Morrissey contract. They're just showing unconfirmed, so they're assuming both years the same. But they can. Another very good comparable to Nurse, which we hope isn't a real good comparable in the sense, is Jacob Trouba 2 years ago in Winnipeg that held out until November the 7th he finally signed. And he signed 2 years, $6 million, and he split it so that it was 2.5 for the first year and 3.5 for the second year. And in that case, that kind of lowered the amount of money that he lost by holding out, but it also raised his platform. And this is a key issue. And we saw it this summer with Ryan Strome, that he came to Edmonton with a $2.5 million cap hit, but the contract he'd signed was $2 million the first year, $3 million the second year. So that when they had to qualify him and sort of set the platform for the next negotiation, it was the $3 million most recent salary that held sway. So that's what they had to qualify him at. Basically, they signed him for 3.1. So they stayed right there. So one thing the Nurse camp can do is say, well, if we sign 2 years at $3.25 million, let's go 2.75 the first year, 3.75 the second year, and then we'll have that higher platform to negotiate off of in 2020 when this thing comes due.
See what happens. The other interesting thing, Bruce, so with the Oilers are playing against the Flames tonight. The Flames' main team is in China playing, so it's going to be more of a minor league team in Calgary, and we'll see who the Oilers put out there. So there's not much to say about the game, except I'm going to be really looking for one thing here, and that's the new tactics. The Oilers coaches have been talking about playing, changing things up on the forecheck, being more aggressive, playing faster hockey. You've heard this before. Last year's team struck me as being a pretty passive team. So it's good to hear this. But Jason Strudwick was at training camp, former Oilers defenseman, and who has become a really sound, strong, and articulate hockey analyst on TSN 1260. I really like his work. So he was watching practice. He's looking for what they're actually trying to teach the players, what systems they're teaching the players, and they got to teach them now. They're not hiding anything. They got to get these guys to learn this stuff. And what he essentially noticed is they're really in both the defensive and offensive zone. When the opposing team when the puck goes into the offensive zone, when it's in the Oilers zone and the opposing team has it in the corner, the Oilers are going to employ a system where they really go after that player with the puck, the opposing player with the puck, and try to win that puck. So defender in hard in the defensive zone, the defender in hard, another guy goes in there to help him out. The other defender who might be in the slot otherwise is kind of creeping over, hoping to win the puck as well. And in the offensive zone, there's a guy on the puck, there's another guy on the puck, trying to win the puck in the corner, and then there's a guy right on the faceoff dot down low. So this, in the defensive zone, Bruce, sounds kind of similar to the Swarm. And all the Swarm is aggressive defensive hockey, really. And you can play aggressive defensive hockey if you have players who are smart enough and tenacious enough and skilled enough and stay on the right side of their man enough to play aggressive defensive hockey. The weird thing when Dallas Eakins famously brought in the Swarm was he hadn't looked at video of his team, and he inherited a team that was sorely lacking in defensive fundamentals. And he didn't even know that. And he admitted as much. He said, well, I realized these guys didn't, I had to go back and just teach the fundamentals, you know, five games in, and I started to do that. So it was this colossal failure. It probably ruined Devin Dubnyk's career. That was Dubnyk's last year, wasn't
it? That was his last half year as an Oiler. And my everlasting, enduring vision of the Swarm that's emblazoned on my mind is from Game 4 of that season in Toronto. This was an epic game where Eakins also benched Nail Yakupov on the first nationally televised game in the Eastern. And they had the Swarm, and they had four guys go into the corner, and they all got beaten by one pass that went to Joffrey Lupul right in front of the net about 10 feet out, and he took a one-time slap shot into the top corner. And then the friggin' TV guys spent the entire intermission criticizing how Dubnyk should have made the save on that play. some of the worst analysis I've ever seen. It's like, hello, one-time slap shot from 10 feet by a 30-goal scorer? Yeah, he's probably going to put it in the net once in a while, wouldn't you say?
So, Bruce, I'm really optimistic. Good. About this, because McClellan, unlike Eakins, he knows his players. He knows them inside out. He knows what they can do and can't do. He's an excellent teaching coach. And if they do have defensive, any issues in fundamentals, and I didn't see a lot of fundamental issues last year, honestly. It was more like guys who looked hurt and couldn't get the job done, frankly. There was, I think, issues in overall aggressiveness and team confidence and something wrong with the team spirit last year. But they look, you know, Adam Larson is a fundamentally sound defensive hockey player. So, you know, and Draisaitl and McDavid are pretty fundamentally sound too in terms of their centers, and Strome as well, I think. You know, that team that Eakins had that he didn't know what he had, they had Will Acton. I guess he knew, they brought in Will Acton as one of their centers. They had Sam Gagne, who was always forever fishing for the puck and on the wrong side of the puck in the defensive zone. Like, he was like a center crying to be a winger his entire time here. They had Nugent Hopkins, who was a third-year player and is, I think, a sound enough defensive center. But I don't think at that time was exceptional at it. And who else? Did they have Belanger still?
Yak.
They had Yak. They had Jordan Eberle, Taylor Hall. Like, none of these players, Hall, Eberle, and Yakupov in Edmonton at that time, were not in any way strong defensive players. And their defenseman, Bruce, Justin Schultz, who was a mess on defense. They had Andrew Ferentz, who knew what he was doing, but he was, you know, getting older then. They had Petrie, who was a good defenseman. They had Philip Larson, who could not play a lick of defense. Martin Marincin, who was kind of a soft defender in his own zone. You know, he was mobile but soft. They had Nick Schultz, who was slow. They had Anton Belov, who was slow. Ugh.
Andrew Ferentz
didn't work. Yeah, Ferentz. So they didn't have Bruce. They didn't have the team to do anything. You know, no matter, probably Eakins was screwed no matter what he did, if we're completely honest about it.
So I'm visualizing this play, where the puck goes into the defensive corner, and Darnell Nurse goes into the corner to, Nurse is signed and happy and on the team now. So he goes into the corner to battle for the puck. And the center who's on the ice at the time, and we'll call him Kyle Brodziak, he goes in hard in support. And the other defenseman, Matt Benning, shades over on the puck side to try and get in the passing lane. And now it's just a matter of having Drake Kajula or Zach Cassian covering the low slot in front of the net. That's going to end well.
Well, this is where it could break. This is where it could break down, my friend, and you've nailed it. But you have the three other guys you mentioned, though.
That puck don't get out.
Yeah, they are built for this more aggressive system. This is going to help them. It's going to give the message, Nurse, Dreisaitl, or which center did you mention, Brodziak, get in there and win that puck, and they're going to do it. So then all the coaches, they listen, Todd McClellan knows he has Zach Cassian and Drake Caggiula, and he's thinking, okay, every single day, five times a day, yeah, I'm going to say to Drake Caggiula and Zach Cassian, cover the low slot. Cover the low slot. Cover the effing low slot. Cover the low slot. Cover the low slot. Like it's just one message. It's going to be really simple for them, right? Because he knows the other guys. He doesn't have to do that with them. They know what they're going to do. They're all smart hockey players, and they're good hockey players. So I think this has a chance to succeed. Like, okay, I have my questions too in the defensive zone, if I'm completely honest. I don't know if this is going to work, but I think it probably will be at least as good as last year. And last year wasn't very good at all. So it probably will be better than last year. Last year wasn't working. So this, but what I really love, Bruce, is how this plays out in the offensive zone, because this really aggressive offensive attacking and forechecking the offensive zone, I think completely suits the games of players like Jujhar Khaira, Zach Cassian, Caggiula, even Jesse Puljujärvi, McDavid, Dreisaitl. These huge, fast guys, like I kind of, and here's the obligatory 1970s, 1980s sports reference. I kind of pictured the Georgetown Hoyas of that era with, Patrick Ewing and Reggie Williams and all these guys doing the full court press. All these big, rangy, fast defenders and attackers getting in there aggressively when the other team has the ball, the puck, getting on them and just creating mayhem. And just what that does for those guys' confidence, for a Puljujärvi, for a Strom, and Strudwick said it. He said the players will like this. They'll play on their toes. They'll be engaged. I really think offensively, I have no doubt that like this is the way to go. Unleash these guys on the attack, like unleash the hounds, like go for it.
Yeah, well, at their base, they're attacking players, and you think of attacking. What you do when you have the puck attacking, attacking the net, trying to score. But this is another level of actually attacking the puck and being aggressive on the puck itself and on the forecheck, trying to win that puck. And I mean, obviously, to some degree or other, that's a part of it, of every system. But emphasizing it a little bit, being a more aggressive, go after a team and thinking we've got the we've got the guys that are going to score enough goals off of this that the occasional odd man rush breakdown the other way is worth the cost of doing business. It's an interesting strategy. Let's see how it works. At least I'm relatively confident that the coaches have watched video of the players and have an idea as to their tendencies. And it's, I still can't get over that, man. And it was, In the attacking zone, yeah, I love it. Defensive zone, well, let's see.
If Dallas Eakins had gone over video, Bruce, of the team heading in, I don't think he would have shown up for training. Probably Kevin Lowe said, "Don't watch the video, man. Just come in and make your own assessment." Because McTavish and him wanted Eakins to show up. Oh. When you look at the rosters on those teams, they were lacking in the player. They just didn't have people who could do the job. They did not, and it wasn't even close. This team does. I love the idea of McDavid unleashed and Puljujärvi unleashed and Dreisaitl unleashed and just going for it. And because essentially, what the other system is more that they played last year was in the offensive end was more of a read and react, right? Like the high guy is kind of looking where it's going and then he's got to figure it out. And does that really suit Zach Cassian or even Jesse Puljujärvi's game? Like maybe better just get in there and go for it, boys, and see how that turns out. I just love aggressive attacking hockey. And I think that's clearly what's going to be happening here. So even if it doesn't work, I'd rather see them go for it and fail than not go for it. So, and I think they have the talent to go for it. And again, the defensive zone. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope Cam Talbot and Koskinen are up for stopping a few triple A scoring chances, Bruce. because there's going to be a few of them.
Yeah, well, it's more exciting. I mean, there's nothing more exciting than seeing Joffrey Lupul wind up for a 10-foot slap shot. Yeah, they've got, and the offensive zone, though, I mean, the whole idea is you shake a puck free, and then that's what you do next, right? And if you shake a puck free and it goes to McDavid or Draisaitl, chances are real good they're going to find either a chance for themselves or someone in real good position. We saw actually two examples of that during the workout on Saturday. One where the puck got shaken loose to Draisaitl, and he did the old spin around right on to Tobias Reeder's tape, and he scored a goal on the shot. And similar at the far end where a puck got checked loose to McDavid, and he found Ty Ratty for a tap-in. You know, it was sort of – I went from turnover to in the net in about 2 seconds in each case. And that's clearly what the objective would be, is to force those turnovers and hopefully have those pucks landing on the right sticks.
Well, let's watch this. Let's watch for this in the preseason games and see what we see. It's going to take a while, obviously, to teach – Kajula and Cassian, like whatever they're, we don't know exactly what the system's going to be, but whatever it is for some of the players to to realize it, maybe this is a system. Maybe these systems are all very subtle and little changes make a big difference in how it works, but maybe fundamentally it's a system to try to maximize the defensive capabilities of your defensemen and centers and have the wingers in a little less important position defensively, because you know you've got centers and defensemen who can play, I think. You're more confident of that than you are on the defensive abilities of the wingers. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe it's simplifying things for those wingers so they don't have a lot of reads. Maybe it's real simple for them. It's like, if the puck's here, you cover him. If it's there, you cover him. And it's like one decision you got to make. And that's it for those guys. So we don't know how the system exactly works, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Well, tonight we'll see. Whatever we see tonight probably won't be much of a tell, because Calgary's much of their primary team is in China, also known as Almost Far Enough. And the team we'll be seeing, I suspect, will have quite a few of the same young fellows that we saw playing the rookie games twice last week. And so, you know, if the Oilers unleash the hounds on those guys, it'll be a mismatch. I frankly expect to see a pretty young Edmonton lineup tonight and maybe a little deeper team when they play out in Vancouver tomorrow night.
Yeah, I think they have to play a certain number of NHL players, though, don't they? Maybe that rule might be relaxed for Calgary. Is it relaxed for both teams in this game?
Yeah, well, I think it's certainly relaxed for Calgary, and they'll likely relax it for both teams. This is where having these PTOs and stuff, you know, I mean, you probably see Jason Garrison play tonight. Just if they have to get up to some limit. It used to be you had to have 13 guys that had some kind of NHL or pro level experience out of your 20. And I honestly don't know what the current things are. And there are, sometimes they lighten the restrictions when you have these traveling situations like Flames have now, and the Oilers will later in the preseason. But it being the preseason, the NHL doesn't generally publish much about what their rules and regulations are. They charge the same for a ticket, but everything else about a preseason game is a little bit below the standard that you would expect in the regular season.
So, Bruce, you suggest that China is almost far enough. Right? So where would far enough be? Mongolia, Kamchatka?
Calgary?
Irkutsk?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Elon Musk is talking about sending that spacecraft to Mars, right?
Maybe that's what they'll
move. Of course, it wouldn't be the same without Calgary, but one of the reasons that makes it fun is that you can make these random remarks about Vancouver, too. Let's face it.
Maybe, maybe that's where they'll move to team. Mars. The Mars Flames. Hell of a road trip. And getting back to Earth and then having to play someone is really, really hard. It's just so hard.
Kamchatka would be difficult.
Kamchatka, yeah. Yakutsk and Irkutsk. We all know these places.
You used to play Risk.
Risk, yeah. Kyrgyzstan. No, that wasn't in Risk. That's the Kyrgyzstan Flames. All right, man. Well, we'll talk again tonight if we can both watch the game, I guess. There's a you never know with these internet feeds who's going to be able to watch it and who can't. I generally have not been able to in years past.
Tomorrow's kind of game in Vancouver tomorrow is actually on TV on Sportsnet.
Good stuff.
So we'll see, be able to watch on the big screen and whatever that's worth in September. Normally, I'd say hockey gets more serious after the snow flies, but this year kind of puts pay to that.
Yeah. All righty, Bruce, let's leave it there. Thanks for talking.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.